You are now listening to the OrthoBullets podcast.
This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be another adapted OrthoBullets core webinar from the OrthoBullets core curriculum, and this one will cover the topic of distal humerus fractures from the trauma section. The topic will be reviewed by Dr. Joaquin Sanchez Sotelo, who is an upper and lower extremity surgeon at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
So, starting with distal humerus fractures, remember that they can be classified in different ways based on the extent of the fracture lines and the location. And it's important to understand that a patient will sustain a fracture of the elbow in different locations based on the position of the elbow. So depending on the elbow flexion, the mechanism of injury is such that will create either a fracture of the olecranon or a fracture of the distal humerus, typically supra-intercondylar fracture. And of course, these patients not uncommonly will have associated injuries. They can have a fracture with a dislocation. They can have a so-called floating elbow. Remember that all these injuries have the potential of creating a large hematoma that by gravity will drain to the forearm and can create the condition for a compartment syndrome that, if left untreated, will lead to a Bogman's contracture. So the prognosis is actually not great. If you read the literature, up to one of every four patients, or 25%, will have an unsatisfactory outcome. And this is especially the case when the fracture lines are especially low, and of course, if there is a lot of comminution, that will make fixation more difficult. Now, when you read about distal humerus fractures, sometimes the questions in the OITE and the board exam will merge with pediatric orthopedics as well. And as you know, the MILS classification was designed mostly for pediatric distal humerus fractures. But in general, it's important to realize that as we classify these fractures with multiple systems that we will review next, we have to identify the main segments that were fractured, and these typically include, to some extent, the lateral column and or the medial column or the arch between the two. So the most simple classification is the AO-OTA classification that, as in any other location of the human anatomy, will distinguish in three basic types. Type 1 is extra-articular. And of these, 80% place the distal foramen in extension. Type B are intra-articular, and most of the times affecting either the medial or the lateral column. And then type C are intra-articular, where both columns are affected, and most of the times there is a separation between the humeral shaft and the distal humerus. As I mentioned before, the MILS classification is mostly for pediatric orthopedic fractures. Jupiter classified these fractures, trying to understand the complexity of these injuries, in a high and a low T. So this is based on how the fracture divides the distal humerus in a T fashion, but the transverse arch portion of the T would be more low. And then using Greek letters, a Y type, an H type, a medial lambda, and a lateral lambda. It's important to realize that in an H fracture, the capitellum will be a completely independent fragment, and then this fracture is supposed to be associated with a higher risk of avascular necrosis. When a patient sustains a distal humerus fracture, the presentation is quite impressive. Most of the times there is major elbow pain and swelling. And remember that these injuries are the results of a very high energy accident, and not uncommonly there may be an association with injuries to either the vessels, typically the brachial artery, or the nerves that are around the elbows, so the median nerve, the ulnar nerve, and occasionally the radial nerve. And one more time, remember that if a patient develops a compartment syndrome of a forearm and it's left untreated, the outcome is the Bogman contracture that is really devastating for the patient function. In terms of imaging studies, basic images would be an AP and a lateral of the elbow. And it's important to include, if possible, the whole length of the humerus and the forearm, because that way it is less likely that the treating orthopedic surgeon will miss associated injuries. In my experience, it's very useful to obtain x-rays in the operating room with the floor machine under traction, because that will really help you understand the location of the fragments. But I think it's fair to say that use of computer tomography has really changed how we plan these fractures. And in my practice, I typically don't use a CT scan if I'm going to replace the elbow, but if I'm going to fix it, 100% of my patients get a CT scan with 3D recon, because it really helps with the surgical planning, and it's been proven in many studies that it will improve also the intra and the inter or cerebral reliability of all the classification systems that we discussed before. So when would you consider no surgery? Typically in the pediatric population with a MILD type 1 fracture. And other than that, you would consider doing a surgery. So let's move to the next question. This is an 88-year-old female patient that presents after a fall into her left arm, and she reports isolated left elbow pain. The x-rays, pretty complex supraintracondylar fracture in a patient that had previously some extent of articular damage. So in this patient, the options for treatment include ORIF, no surgery, and so on. I think the literature would support use of an elbow arthroplasty for this patient. And the explanation is pretty clear. This patient is very low demand, 88, female. An elbow arthroplasty has been proven in comparative studies to be better than ORIF in this patient population. And more importantly, once the implants are cemented, since this operation is done with the triceps on, these patients can start using their elbow in a couple of weeks. So as soon as their skin incision is healed, they can start to get on with their life, and then they depend less on social support or family support. A study that was led by Dr. Mike McKee from Canada, this was a prospective randomized study that compared ORIF with elbow arthroplasty and showed that with 2 years of follow-up, the outcome was better with elbow arthroplasty as compared to internal fixation. Now, how do you do the operation? In terms of positioning, there is controversy about how to do it. If the number of assistants is limited in your practice, the lateral decubitus position is very helpful because you can get by with only one assistant. In my practice, I prefer to place the patients supine. I remember this is particularly helpful for the anesthesia team if you have a polytrauma patient. In terms of the approach, the olecranon osteotomy has been proven to provide the widest exposure to the articular surface of the distal humerus. Other exposures can be helpful, but they don't provide as much exposure. So I would think that most surgeons would prefer to do an olecranon osteotomy except in the very simple supracondylar fracture without intra-articular extension or in the fracture that has only a single intra-articular fracture line. This is an approach that is very dear to my heart because Dr. Alonso Llames was from Madrid, Spain, from the hospital where I trained as a resident, and he developed this exposure when he described how to do distal humerus osteotomies in children. But in this exposure that is called paratricipital approach, one works on either side of the triceps, and this can only be used successfully in patients that have either a supracondylar fracture, a low transcondylar, for example, or a fracture that has only one intra-articular line. Now, the benefit is that you can always start with a paratricipital approach and then convert to an olecranon osteotomy if needed. Steps for the triceps sparing or Alonso Llames approach. On the medial side, of course, you have to identify the ulnar nerve, and in my practice, I transpose it, although we will talk about the benefits of transposing versus keeping it in place later on. And then you elevate the triceps from the posterior aspect of the humerus to gain access to the fracture. And most of the times, in order to access the joint, you have to divide the posterior capsule, including the posterior band of the MCL. And then you go to the lateral side. If the fracture is pretty high, it may be important to identify the location of the radial nerve so that it's not injured by our exposure or by plate fixation. If it's a lower fracture, maybe it's not necessary to identify the radial nerve. And then again, elevating the triceps from the humeral shaft from lateral will allow the completion of the exposure. And if necessary, for distal exposure, the anconeus may be divided. So once we are going to the more complex supra-intra-articular fractures, especially with a comminution, I think the olecranon osteotomy is the workhorse for many of us, and that's the main indication. The exception would be the patient where you are considering an elbow arthroplasty. So in those patients that you are not decided, if you consent the patient for both and you will make your decision intraoperatively, I think it's best to start with the Alonso Llames approach, assess the fracture, and if you think it's completely unfixable, then resect the fragments and do the elbow arthroplasty as we discussed before. If, on the other hand, you realize that the fracture is fixable, then you can convert the Alonso Llames into an olecranon osteotomy. And the key is to identify the bare area of the sigmoid notch, and the way I do that is by dividing the posterior capsule of the elbow and the posterior band of the MCL and using a retractor to lever up the ulna, and you can actually, looking through the medial side of the joint, identify the location of the bare area and aim your saw or your osteotome to that particular location. If you're going to end up fixing your osteotomy with a screw, I think it's wise to pre-drill for the screw. If you will use a plate, you can also consider placing the plate and at least a few screw holes so that your reduction will be anatomic. And it's wise to pass an instrument, either a sponge or maybe lever the ulna up with a couple of Holman retractors to protect the articular surface of the distal humerus, because as you fall into the distal humerus, if the fragments are close to your osteotomy, you can create additional cartilage damage. Some people prefer to do fluoroscopy to control the position of the osteotomy. Myself, I think it's easy to do without using fluoroscopy, and I prefer to do a chevron osteotomy, although some surgeons prefer just a simple transverse cut. And it's important to realize that the saw blade will remove structural material, so it's okay to start with a saw, but it's best to finish your osteotomy with an osteotome, because that will also not only protect the articular cartilage if you end up not falling into the bare area, but also will provide some interdigitation of the osteotomy that will facilitate fixation. And there is also controversy about how to fix the osteotomy. Many surgeons use a screw. You can also use 2K wires and a tension band. Some other surgeons prefer plate fixation, with a study at Mayo that showed that plate fixation for distal humerus fractures potentially can lead to a higher rate of complications. So I have switched from using a plate to going back to tension band wiring. Now, the triceps reflecting or Brian Morey approach was designed for elbow arthroplasty. So my mentor, Dr. Morey, described how to reflect in continuity the triceps and the ankle knees from medial to lateral. But this can also give you a pretty good exposure in patients where you're still thinking about fixing it, but you may replace it. So this is kind of an in-between the Alonso James and the osteotomy in patients where you're undecided and you want to try to decide interoperatively. It's extremely important to understand that since the triceps is detached, it needs to heal. And to heal, it needs to have a very stout repair. So typically we will do a repair with multiple transosseous sutures. And the patient cannot use the elbow to push against resistance or to use the elbow to, for example, lift him or herself from a chair pushing with her hands, because the triceps repair needs to be protected for at least 6 weeks after surgery. And this is another exposure that my other partner, Dr. Driscoll, described. It's called the triceps reflecting anconium's pedicle. This combines a extensile Cocher approach and a Brian Morey, and not only the triceps is detached from the olecranon, but the anconeus is mobilized with the triceps as well. In terms of the deep exposure, you have to work around the extensors and the flexors to get access to the distal fragments, and it's important not to devascularize the fragments even more than the fracture already did. So we try to make an effort to be very careful with the origins of the flexors and extensors so that we don't devascularize the fragments anymore. This technique of fixation, I believe, has become the gold standard, especially for the most complex fractures. And when this technique was described, and I was the lead author of this paper when I was a fellow with Dr. Driscoll, the idea was that the reason why non-unions happen is because typically fixation distally is compromised and there is no real compression. So we came up with a number of goals where basically the idea is that if you use pre-contoured parallel plates, you can get a lot of screws in the distal fragment, and the goal is to have each screw on the distal fragment contribute to fixation between the supracondylar region and the distal articular fragments. And if the screws that you're placing from medial to lateral engage on the opposite fragment, that will give you even more stability. And of course, as these screws meet each other on the distal fragment, they interdigitate and they create the same fixed angle construct that you could get if you used locking screws. It's very important to realize that the most common location of non-union is at the supracondylar level, and for those reasons it is extremely important to try to achieve compression at the supracondylar level. And finally, the plates that are used for fixation have to be strong and stiff enough, because if you use flimsy plates, for example, there was a time where people would use thin non-reconstruction plates, they would fracture easily before the fracture was healed. And of course, if there is individual small fragments, one can add also a small headless screws, or you can countersunk regular screws. But the workhorse of fixation of the columns is by use of parallel plating. Now, what about the ulnar nerve? This is extremely controversial. And the best evidence is by Dr. McKee again. He just finished a prospective randomized study where some patients were randomized to having a transposition in the subcutaneous pocket medially, and some were randomized to keeping the nerve inside at the end of the case, and there was no differences. So I think it's fair to say that this is a surgeon's choice. Having said that, if at the end of the case the nerve is going to be in contact with metal, I think most surgeons would agree that it's better to transpose the nerve anteriorly. And then after surgery, our preference is to immobilize the elbow in some extension. I myself aim to about 20 degrees or so. It's important to keep the elbow at a higher height than the heart so that the venous flow will decrease edema. And then 2 or 3 days after surgery, the dressing can be removed and the patient can start gentle range of motion exercises. Rotation is no big deal because that is the function of the radius around the ulna, and that typically is not affected by the fracture. And then a strengthening typically starts at 6 weeks. So let's move to another question. This is a 51-year-old carpenter that presents to your clinic with a distal humerus non-union. And then in the question, it says that the non-union is re-repaired, and then the patient is lost to follow-up. And when the patient comes, there is a stiffness. The arc of motion is between 10 degrees of extension and 80 degrees of flexion. So the question is, after trialing braces or physical therapy for a while, if you're not making any progress, what do you have to do to help with this patient's elbow motion? And the answer in this question is almost always related to some extent to the posterior band of the MCL. So something that we elbow surgeons are very familiar with is that the posterior band of the MCL, when contracted, really limits flexion, and in the board questions you will run into this answer multiple times. So the MCL has an anterior band that is responsible for stability against valgus loading, and a posterior band that when contracted will limit flexion. So what are the complications of distal humerus fractures? Elbow stiffness is no question the most common, and this has been questioned multiple times, and HO formation is also not uncommon. And the problem is that prophylaxis for these fractures is tricky, because in the one study that looked at using radiation for distal humerus fractures for HO prevention, there was an unacceptable rate of non-union of the olecranon osteotomy. So most surgeons don't like to use radiation in the acute setting because of the risk of trading absence of HO for non-union, which is a major problem as well. And there is other problems that can occur. Obviously, malunion is another possible complication, and there can be an injury to the anterior interosseous nerve when fixing the olecranon osteotomy. Now we move to another question. This is a 27-year-old male that suffers a crash riding a motorcycle, and as a consequence sustains an isolated right distal humerus fracture that is treated non-operatively. And then 10 months later, he returns complaining of lack of motion. The physical examination shows that the motion is very limited, from 30 to 90 degrees compared to 0 to 130. And then the patient has a fair amount of HO formation, and it is located medially. So you have to think about two things right away. One of them is that the ulnar nerve can be compromised to some extent. And in these patients, it's important to be extremely careful with the ulnar nerve, release it, and not uncommonly transpose it. But also the HO is where? It's located over the posterior band of the MCL. So another example of how in these questions, typically the posterior band of the MCL comes up frequently as a structure-limiting flexion.
That's all for this review on distal humerus fractures. If you would like access to the full video version of these core webinars, sign up for the OrthoBullets core curriculum today. There will be a link in the show notes for anyone who is interested. Look out for questions related to this topic on this weekend's question session, and hopefully this episode will have prepared you for that review. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.